with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
Did you know that 30% of breast cancer mutations occur in women who are not high risk? We'll look at important research from Mayo Clinic to better assess the risks for women with no family history of breast cancer. Then, nearly 10% of Americans still smoke. We'll talk with a distinguished researcher who says whenever a smoker is hospitalized for any reason, hospitals often miss a prime opportunity to extend these patients' lives by helping them quit. And how much of the standard treatment for heart patients is supported by clinical trials and clear scientific data? The answer will surprise you. Stay with us. This week's Med Clinic Radio gets underway in just a moment.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
About 13% of women will get breast cancer at some point in their lives. It's often a major shock when a woman with no family history of breast cancer gets the bad news. Now, a study has yielded more accurate estimates of breast cancer risks for women, even those with no family history. Joining us now is Dr. Fergus Couch, a Mayo Clinic pathologist who led the study. Doctor, the study produced more accurate estimates of breast cancer risk in American women who have inherited so-called variants in certain genes. This could help doctors improve the patient's outcomes. How so?
Well, the approach we mainly take is that because we have better numbers, we can approximate risk in the clinic. So many women won't even be tested, actually, for mutations if they don't have a family history. And what we've shown, we've essentially demonstrated that the number of mutations or the frequency within the population is as much as 5% of women with breast cancer and almost 2% of women without breast cancer carry these mutations. So now with these numbers in hand, clinicians in the clinics at various hospitals can counsel patients adequately, can talk to people of the general population who don't have that family history, whereas before they were normally separated out for that purpose. And then it actually leads to improved treatment for breast and ovarian cancer downstream when people are found to have mutations in certain genes. You can predict the risk of various cancers such as breast, ovarian, pancreatic, and prostate in men. And then it's very useful for family members because they are also maybe inheriting the mutation that the tested person has. And they're also at risk of all these cancers. So early warning systems, can they do prevention to prevent the cancer from ever happening through various surgeries or chemo prevention, chemicals, taking drugs, and then the treatment that I mentioned before. So really a wide-ranging, broad approach that may be beneficial to patients.
And for context currently, what pieces of information do doctors focus upon when they assess a woman's level of breast cancer risk?
Almost uniquely, that the focus is on family history. So it's a family history of breast and ovarian cancer. And they look for how many relatives in first, second, and third degree. So all the way out to first cousins. And then generally, if you have one or two relatives, close relatives with breast or ovarian cancer, you would qualify under so-called NCCN guidelines for clinical genetic testing. There's also some rare types of breast cancer that show up, such as triple negative breast cancer, or others like ovarian cancer. All women with ovarian cancer now qualify for testing. Many men with prostate cancer would qualify for testing because we're finding high rates of mutations. But in breast cancer, it's really just the triple negative breast cancers, which is a particularly aggressive form, that would qualify for testing essentially automatically. But we're really talking here in our study about the many other women who would never even be looked at.
You studied women in one group with breast cancer, as you indicated, and there was another separate group without breast cancer. You looked for variants in certain genes, genes that are known to be predisposed to cancer. For women who don't have a family history or those other factors you mentioned, they were not thought to be at high risk. But does your study bear that out?
It really does. First of all, we don't believe that there's really the important genes here, the ones that are clinically relevant, the 12 that we specifically are talking about today, really had slightly attenuated risks or slightly lower risks than you would see in women with family histories. but the risk was still high enough that there would still be a clinical intervention or an attempt to do prevention of breast cancer in those unaffected women. So the risk was lower, but still clinically important.
We're visiting with Dr. Fergus Couch, a Mayo Clinic pathologist who led a study that resulted in more accurate estimates of how much risk for breast cancer certain women may face. Currently, though, doctors treating any woman doctor who's discovered to have a variant might overestimate the breast cancer risk?
Yes, that's true. If you go in with a family history and they evaluate you for a mutation, certain mutations such as mutations in the BRCA1 or the BRCA2 genes have been thought to cause risk as high as 70% lifetime risk of breast cancer and maybe 40% lifetime risk of ovarian cancer. We found in our studies that it's substantially less than that. It's still it's as low as 40% rather than 70. But again, a 40% lifetime risk is still very, very high. And it would not change the clinical practice. We would still try to do something about that. It's really some of the other genes that we call the moderate risk genes that really only come in at about 20 or 25% lifetime risk of breast cancer. That's only about twofold higher than the general normal population. About 12% of women get breast cancer. But those genes were reduced slightly as well. And so the question then is, would you still have intervention? Would you still follow those individuals over time to see what the mutation means? Maybe there's not a clinical intervention in that particular setting.
And doctor, how did your findings run when categorized by race?
Yes, that was a very interesting part of the study. We did actually have about 5,000 women, African-American women, and then smaller numbers of women with Asian and Hispanic background. So the numbers were a little bit soft for those last two, but certainly for the African-Americans, we were able to show that they had similar numbers of mutations, that the risks were equally high. And then putting the two together, comparing what we call formerly non-Hispanic whites or women of white European extraction compared with African-American women, really very, very similar outcomes. And that really is the first big study of its type to show that in the general population. So that was an important aspect of it, too, that we're trying to generalize our findings to the entire American population.
Any supposition as to why the Asian American women had less prevalence of the variants?
Yes, we did see that, but I will tell you that the numbers were very, very small. The numbers of women in that study were very, very small. So I would take that with a grain of salt. I can't stand by that number and say it's meaningful. It was commented on in the media, certainly, but I would not really be paying attention to that. And my clinical colleagues would not be paying attention to that because the numbers were so small. It's just an inexact number, an inaccurate number.
Coming up, more about the breast cancer study and which genes contain the most concerning risk. Back in a moment.
Return to Med Clinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
Back now to our discussion of the updated estimates of breast cancer risk for women. Our guest is Dr. Fergus Couch of the Mayo Clinic, who led the study. Doctor, to dive down into the numbers here, you studied approximately 32,000 women with breast cancer and another 32,000 without the disease in the United States. How many genes that are known to be predisposed to cancer did you check for variants, and how many did you find?
The panel we used to do the sequencing of the genes included 37 genes, but we had several genes on there that really are not thought to be involved in breast cancer at all. So we honed down to the 12 that are almost certainly involved in breast cancer. There's a lot of data already published on these genes establishing their role. So we went after the 12 genes and looked at them across that entire set of women. And luckily, those women were available to us, not because we went out and recruited them just for this study. They were already participating in large, what we call cohort studies. So very large collections of women, many recruited 20, 30 years ago, followed over time, and a certain number of them then developed breast cancer and others did not. And that's where we were able to, luckily they collected blood samples for DNA to allow us to do our sequencing all those years ago. And we were able to then use those materials for this big study. So really, an unexpected bonus, really, that we were able to find all these huge collections of patients from our collaborators.
And you did mention a moment ago that the genes in which you found the top two most concerning variants were the BRCA1 and 2, some call BRCA1 and BRCA2. Put this in layman's terms, though. What's the chance that if you carry one of these variants in BRCA1 or BRCA2, that you will get breast cancer?
Yes, the risks really are very high. So if you have a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, you're at approximately 70% lifetime risk of getting breast cancer, 40% lifetime risk of ovarian cancer with a BRCA1, maybe only 20% lifetime risk of ovarian cancer with a BRCA2. They do differ a little bit. So very, very high. And even in our study of the general population of women with breast cancer, where I said earlier that it dropped maybe as much as half down to 40%, those are still extremely high risks for any woman to bear. And I think my clinical colleagues would certainly be trying to do something to reduce the risk for each of those women, whether it's better screening with mammography and MRI, or in fact, preventative surgeries. There is also now a third gene, the PALB2 gene, P-A-L-B-2 gene, which was very recently shown to be a high-risk breast cancer gene as well, with risks as high, for breast cancer at least, as high as the BRCA2 gene. So we now really have three high-risk genes that we think about.
Doctor, I think it is so ironic, taking a big step back here. We all have BRCA genes, and when they're normal, they're actually beneficial, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They have a very, very important role in a type of repair of DNA damage. And every cell in our body can acquire DNA damage at all times, just to exposures to the environment and just mistakes in the copying of the DNA. And we have, human cells have tremendous mechanisms for repairing this damage. And the homologous recombination type of damage that BRCA1 and BRCA2 and PALB2 are all involved in is essentially a perfect way to repair certain types of damage. No mistakes are made, and that's why we really continue to have good genomes going forward. So these proteins are absolutely critical for this repair, and so when they're disrupted by these inherited types of mutations, we start to accumulate. We have other backup mechanisms that try to repair that same damage, but they don't work as well, and they do make mistakes, and so we start to acquire additional mutations throughout our genome. And then, of course, this can lead to cancer when it actually impacts an important cancer gene.
We're visiting with Mayo Clinic pathologist Dr. Fergus Couch, who led a major study that more accurately estimates breast cancer risks for women. Doctor, continuing on your findings here, for the genes BARD1, RAD51C, and RAD51D, what types of cancer were they associated with?
Yes, this was an interesting story. We had published some manuscripts a couple of years ago suggesting that they were involved in triple-negative breast cancer. But again, that was in very high-risk women. The RAD51C and RAD51D genes have also been implicated in ovarian cancer. They're actually very high-risk genes in ovarian cancer, but moderate-risk genes in breast. And again, this is where we see differences from one cancer type to another for these genes. It's not always the same. So in this large population-based study, we again found them to be involved in breast cancer and moderate risks of breast cancer. And there was another manuscript published at the same time beside ours in the New England Journal from a large European consortium called Bridges, and they found exactly the same thing. So even though the numbers we found were right on the very edge of moderate risk breast cancer genes, and we didn't have many mutations in each gene, we were able to show fairly definitively, especially with that validation in that other Bridges study, that all three of those genes really do cause breast cancer. And really, it's going to be important to pay attention to them going forward clinically.
And just to round this out, the variants in ATM, CDH1, and CHEK2 were associated with an increased risk of estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer?
Yes, that's the most common form of breast cancer. 70 to 75% of women who get breast cancer are getting what we call ER-positive or estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. It's the more benign type when we compare it to some of the more aggressive ones, such as the triple negatives that I mentioned earlier. But nevertheless, still, we need to deal with this, and it's dangerous going forward, especially in the metastatic setting. So those genes are almost exclusively causing ER-positive or estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. We really could find no evidence that you would see other types of breast cancer, such as triple-negative breast cancer or the fourth type, which is called HER2-positive breast cancer. no evidence of that at all, really. These genes seem to be focused on the estrogen receptor positives. We don't really know the biology of that. We have no idea why that happens, but certainly the risks are very clear.
Doctor, we were talking before about the recommendations of which women should get genetic testing. Aren't the recommendations really all over the board? There are so many different bodies that are authoritative in this matter, and there are different recommendations, are there not?
That's true, and it varies by country as well as within countries. So in the UK, for instance, they have the NICE guidelines. In the United States, we predominantly follow what are called the NCCN guidelines. And this is a voluntary body that comes together and looks at all the information available and then tries to suggest which genes should be checked and what the metrics should be. I would say that most of my clinical colleagues around the country are using the NCCN guidelines at this point, and they're really quite useful. Where it breaks down a little bit is that the guidelines have become incredibly detailed, and it takes quite a lot of time during a clinical visit to gather all the information from the patient and plug it into the various prediction models to see what a patient's risk might be. So by definition, biology is detailed and complicated, and that's what's happening in the clinic as well. The methods of calculating the risks are becoming detailed and calculated, and it can really slow the process down within the clinics. So some of what we've been doing with these numbers is trying to simplify things perhaps and come with just sort of overarching guidelines that collect a whole bunch of patients into very simplistic guidelines that we can move forward with. One of the big questions in our field right now is, should we just be testing every breast cancer patient? So every patient who develops breast cancer, should they get genetic testing for these genes? Yes, they've already developed breast cancer, so the risk of breast cancer doesn't matter too much, but they're at risk of other cancers, such as a second breast cancer, ovarian cancer, pancreatic, in men, the prostate, and of course, their family members could all benefit from that information. And finally, should they progress, if their disease should progress, they may benefit from targeted therapies with drugs called PARP inhibitors in the future.
Doctor, finally, mammograms, of course, would not detect genetic variants, but early disease. However, in light of your findings, do you support annual mammograms for women rather than being tested every 2 years?
Yes, I would, especially, well, certainly in the setting of a family history, we would certainly do that. And now the question is, can we come up with ways to identify the women who might have mutations? We either could test everybody, or if we can't test everybody, can we select women in a better way to say who's at increased risk? Whether that's by family history plus something else, we don't really know right now. But if we could predict who's at increased risk, absolutely, we should be doing frequent screening. You know, you consider some of these genes we've talked about, BRCA1, BRCA2, PALB2, the risk of breast cancer is so high, 70% lifetime for some of those women. We really need to do everything we can to detect it very early where it's still curable rather than missing it. And some of these cancers may grow very rapidly. There's some thought that the BRCA1 breast cancers proliferate or grow very rapidly in the human body. And so if we wait too long between each mammogram, we may miss them. And that's why a lot of these women with known mutations in BRCA1 and 2 already qualify for MRI screening in addition to mammograms, and they switch back and forth every 6 months in the hope that two different ways of looking at the breast might actually do a better job of picking up the cancers very early.
Dr. Fergus Couch with Mayo Clinic, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing news on your breast cancer study.
Happy to do it. Thank you very much.
Up next, 7 million smokers are hospitalized each year. How many lives could be saved if hospitals helped inpatients quit smoking? We'll talk to a highly respected researcher next as MedClinic Radio continues.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Roughly 10% of all Americans are smokers, and cigarette smoking causes 480,000 premature deaths each year in the United States. Now, a leading researcher and colleagues wrote a commentary published in the Ochsner Medical Journal on what they say is a missed opportunity to avoid many premature deaths. Joining us now is that researcher, Dr. Charles Hennekens, senior author, the first Sir Richard Dahl professor, and senior academic advisor in the Schmidt College of Medicine at Florida Atlantic University. Doctor, welcome. Your commentary focuses on patients who land in the hospital for several days. Exactly what is the missed opportunity?
Well, the missed opportunity is that each year we have 7 million U.S. smokers hospitalized for an average of several days. And if we were to start smoking cessation during the hospitalization and maintain high adherence to that program after discharge, we would markedly improve the quit rates with minimal to no side effects.
And the patients then are something of a captive audience, is that it?
Exactly. And it's a captive audience in which long-term counseling could begin, as well as at least 90 days of prescription drug therapy, particularly varenicline. They have the potential to reduce avoidable premature deaths from cigarette smoking, which remain alarmingly high and even greater unnecessarily high in the United States and has already become so worldwide.
Doctor, let me ask you to drill down on that. The first step would be the program to get people to kick the habit, that is intense counseling. Can you drill down on that for us and tell us what that would entail?
Well, it entails one-on-one and group sessions that help you with strategies to do so. But I think one of the game changers has been the advent of varenicline, which is a smoking cessation drug, which has minimal side effects and has a very large amount of randomized evidence to indicate that we could get permanent quitting rates between about a fifth and a third of all patients, which is an extraordinarily high permanent quit rate.
And what does this drug actually do to our brains? How does it work?
Well, the drug basically, one of, I think it's potentially great beneficial effects was the idea that smoking isn't addictive. It has an addictive component. And this particular drug works on the brain to satisfy that addictive component by the drug rather than by the cigarettes.
So people feel satisfied.
Yes.
It's a satiation that they get.
One of the reasons we can say this with assurance is that colleagues of mine at UCSD San Diego and then at Harvard have done two large randomized trials, each among about 4,000 patients. And there were 4,000 patients without severe mental illness and 4,000 people with mental illness. And the efficacy of varenicline was far superior to both bupropion and the nicotine patch, which themselves were superior to placebo. And most importantly, there were no significant increases in side effects, including neuropsychiatric symptoms in the general population, or even those with severe mental illness. In fact, in the general population, there was a suggestion of improvement in neuropsychiatric symptoms, and of course, no suggestion of any harm in those with severe mental illness who already have many neuropsychiatric symptoms. This, I think, is a remarkable breakthrough because, as we've pointed out, patients with severe mental illness already have a reduced life expectancy by maybe 20 to 25 years over the general population. And the smoking rates among that population are as high as 75%. And they have such high rates of premature deaths. It was thought in the past it was due to suicide, but in fact, the majority of their deaths are due to heart attacks. And one of the chief risk factors for that heart attack is their cigarette smoking habits. So this is quite a remarkable breakthrough. And when And I think this offers great hope to reduce premature deaths from cigarette-related diseases. I think it's important that the general public know that if you stop smoking today, within a very short time, you will start to see benefits on your risks of heart attacks. And within several years, we've shown that your risk comes back to that of the person who never smoked. And we've demonstrated that even into the oldest old, people over age 65 who quit smoking have permanent quit rates so that within 2 or 3 years, their risks of heart attacks are back to that of the non-smoker, leading to my statement that for heart attacks, it's never too late to quit. Now, that's in contrast to cancer, because for heart disease, it's the amount you currently smoke that's the risk factor. But for cancer, it's the duration. And if you stop today, you won't have any benefit even begin to appear for several years after you quit. And even 10 years later, the benefit on cancer is only midway between that of the continuing smoker and the non-smoker. And so many of us have heard friends, relatives, acquaintances, people on TV who stopped smoking 10, 15 years ago and die from lung cancer. So for heart attacks, it's never too late to quit. For cancer, it's never too early to quit. And another point for the general population to hear is that a 4-pack-a-day smoker for 10 years has a much higher risk of a heart attack than a 1-pack-a-day smoker for 40 years. In contrast, the person who smoked 1-pack for 40 years has an astronomically higher risk of lung cancer than the 4-pack-a-day smoker for 10 years, because it's the duration of the habit that counts. So I think the general public should know death is inevitable, premature death is not. But as you yourself pointed out, 480,000 Americans die prematurely from cigarettes each year. In contrast, COVID-19 during this last year has basically affected maybe 550,000 Americans, and worldwide, 2.8 million people have died from COVID, whereas from cigarettes, 7 million people die worldwide from cigarettes. So it's still a huge clinical and public health problem.
I do see that the rates of smoking have gone down somewhat, but we're hearing many warnings about young people vaping. Do you believe they feel that vaping is a safe version of smoking?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, there is no safe version of smoking. And you're quite right that the rates have declined dramatically. There are still 35 million current smokers in the United States. And one of the unfortunate things in the U.S. is that many times the targeting is towards the young people, and it's certainly, and towards minorities as well, and this is true worldwide, which is why cigarettes is such a major clinical and public health problem.
How would you counsel the parents listening to us right now on what to tell their kids if they learn that their kids are vaping?
Well, this is a tough one. I think they've got to get to their source of medical care and have that health care provider help to try to counsel the young person to try to get them to stop. Unfortunately, in young ages, there is an aura of invincibility, and people can't really relate to what might happen down the line. But of course, at the other end of the spectrum, there are people who say, if I knew what the facts were, I would have taken better care of myself.
And regarding your recommendation that hospitals help patients quit smoking, are there regular or even just pilot programs like what you're suggesting in some hospitals around the country or elsewhere in the world?
Oh, yes. In the United States, there are hospitals that are attempting to do so. But I think they're few and far between, which is why we felt that drawing attention to this could avoid a large number of premature deaths because long-term counseling and this adjunctive drug therapy would markedly improve the permanent quit rates with minimal to no side effects.
And are there any studies or even just data on whether programs of this type are getting results?
Well, there are some pilot programs in a few places throughout the country that are certainly suggesting encouraging results. But as I say, they're few and far between.
And even non-smokers have a stake in this, don't they, in the issue of secondhand smoke?
Well, certainly. I think the good news is that the risks of secondhand smoke are only about one-tenth that of active smoking. So if you've got to double the risk of a heart attack, maybe it's just about a 20% higher risk, or if it's a 20-fold increase in lung cancer from long-term smoking, it's a 2-fold for the passive smoker. But it still would result in avoidable deaths. It's really a difficult problem because I think that that was one of the ways that we got these rates to come down so much in the U.S. was the realization that when you smoke, you have the right to kill yourself early if that's your wish, but you have the responsibility to not kill the people who are downwind of your cigarette smoke.
Doctor, as you know, most everything comes down to cost. So if hospitals roll out an anti-smoking program for patients, administrators would likely say, who's going to pay for this? Do insurance companies typically cover programs to quit smoking?
Well, I really can't answer that question. The U.S. Healthcare system in general is characterized by numerous high-cost, low-value services. We believe, and we've said so in the paper, that of the services performed, the value for dollar of smoking cessation would be really quite favorable compared to many other things that are done.
Dr. Charles Hennekens with the Schmidt School of Medicine at Florida Atlantic University, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity to share my work.
Coming up in a moment, what percentage of treatments used by heart doctors are based on clinical trials and hard science? We'll talk to a cardiologist from Duke University Medical Center for the surprising answer, next on MedClinic Radio.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
When a doctor says he or she is treating us based on guidelines, many of us believe that's a solid basis for decisions about our care. But when it comes to heart disease, the guidelines are now coming into question. A new study shows less than 10% of heart care guidelines are based on, shall we say, the gold standard of research. What does it mean? Joining us now is the study's lead author, Dr. Alexander Fanaroff of the Duke University Medical Center. Doctor, before we dive into the details, your team is saying more than 90% of the heart care guidelines are based on lower quality research. Do you have an opinion one way or another as to whether these are worthwhile guidelines?
I would say the guidelines are worthwhile. They give really the best sense of the consensus of the community in cardiology as to how we should take care of our patients. And, you know, we have to take care of our patients. We have to take care of them as best we can. So I do think the guidelines are worthwhile. The question is whether we can make better guidelines by generating better evidence.
The presumption is, of course, when doctors stick to the guidelines, the patient is likely to improve, right?
Yes, and there is some evidence showing that when physicians stick to guidelines, their patients do better than physicians who don't stick to the guidelines.
And we should point out that while guidelines are extremely important, they're not hard and fast rules. So if more heart doctors were aware of your study results, would it be appropriate for them to rely less on the guidelines?
It's always best to rely on the guidelines. What our study shows is that in some areas, the guidelines are imperfect. One of the things that is important to note is that in some cases, there is excellent evidence for the recommendations that the guidelines make. And I think this is particularly the case for most of our drugs and many of our devices. In those cases, the evidence is on solid footing. And these are things like controlling blood pressure and controlling cholesterol. The evidence for doing those things and using those medicines is very good. So where the evidence is solid, physicians should certainly rely on the guidelines. Where the evidence is a little bit less solid, using clinical judgment may come into play.
Committees that write the guidelines put them into categories A, B, and C based on the level of research supporting them. Can you describe for us each level by category?
We'll start with level of evidence A, and level of evidence A represents the gold standard. This is evidence from either multiple randomized controlled trials or a single large, well-done randomized controlled trial. And I think it's important to understand what a randomized controlled trial is. A randomized controlled trial is when physicians or researchers basically take a group of patients and randomly assign them to one treatment or to another. And often one of those treatments that they're assigned to is a placebo or a sugar pill or no intervention at all. And then they follow them for important outcomes. And in most cases, neither the patient nor the researchers are aware of which group the patient belongs to. And in that way, you can basically, because of the randomization process, assume that the patients in each group are totally equal, that physician judgment didn't play a role in which treatment they got, and you can really trust that any difference in outcomes was caused by the treatments that you're investigating, either the treatment that the patient was randomly assigned to. So treatments, guideline recommendations supported by randomized controlled trials are level of evidence A. Level of evidence B are when you have either one small trial or more often what we call observational studies. And in an observational study, basically patients are treated the way that their physician thinks they ought to be treated. And, you know, you can look at which treatment patients got, and you can use some statistical techniques to make the patients that got, you know, one treatment or the other look similar at baseline. And you can see basically how they did over long-term follow-up based on which treatment they got. The problem with observational studies like this is that even though you can use statistical techniques to adjust away baseline differences, that's never perfect. And you never know whether patients have differences that you may not have measured. So that's level of evidence B. Level of evidence C is strictly expert opinion. So, you know, you consult the eminences in the field, who are often the ones writing the guidelines, and they remember the patients they treat. They use a knowledge of pathology and physiology and really important things, but no systematic evidence.
And so 91% of the guidelines fell into categories B and C.
Yes.
Is this of any alarm?
I would say that it's cause for alarm. It should be a call to action to really generate more randomized controlled trials so that we can have higher quality evidence. The thing about recommendations that are level evidence B or C is that in the next iteration of the guidelines, we may know more. We may have done better research, and we may find out that we have not been treating patients correctly. And there's some evidence to bear out the fact that recommendations that are level of evidence A don't tend to be overturned when guidelines are updated. And recommendations that are level evidence B or C are sometimes overturned or more often overturned than level evidence A. So I would stop short of saying it's cause for alarm, but I would say it should be a call to action to really generate more high-quality evidence.
In this era of electronic patient charts and such, why don't we have more and better data to support guidelines?
Traditionally, clinical trials have kind of existed outside of patient care. The challenge really, though, is that electronic health record data does not talk to each other really as well as one might think. Collecting data from Duke doesn't mean that you can collect the same data from the University of North Carolina or any other institution because the data really is separate. So one thing that I think would facilitate doing more randomized controlled trials is really having the electronic health records be able to talk to each other and generate really usable data for clinical trials. That is the way of the future, and a lot of people are working on that. And hopefully when we do this type of study in 10 years, we'll be able to say that we really have taken a big step forward in the level of evidence supporting guidelines.
Dr. Alexander Fanaroff of Duke University Medical Center, good luck to you, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that wraps up this week's installment of MedClinic Radio, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll join us again next time for more MedClinic Radio. Syndication.